Bat Segundo here, and I'm here to report that the Bat Segundo show may be at an end. You see, after reading Miss Naomi Wolf's book, I realized that when America goes, the Bat Segundo show may go. I realize that our young roving correspondent has been needlessly fascist in relation to some guests, that he has been successfully depriving them of their civil liberties, and even tried out a few helpful waterboarding techniques. I realize that there is something within this particular episode, and I don't know what it is, that is the first of 10 steps that Miss Wolf outlines in her book. Thus, Naomi Wolf has forecast the end of the Bat Segundo show, and she should be commended, because I'm beginning to lose my lunch.
Okay. So I'm here with Naomi Wolf, who is the author of The Beauty Myth and most recently The End of America. Naomi, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you.
First off, I wanted to actually ask you about, I guess we can talk about The End of America. You're not, of course, the first person to say this. Back in 1829, James Madison made a rather interesting pronouncement that the American Republic had more or less 100 years left, and he was actually quite prescient in light of the fact that lined up almost perfectly with the Great Depression. So really, is this kind of the end, or is there maybe a natural end to the American Republic?
Well, I would hate to think that, we'll just let this great experiment wither on the vine, especially because the consequences to us are so personal and so great and so scary, really. When I say the end of America, what I mean is that, you know, we have been blessed with over 200 years, I mean, you know, granted some eclipses, as you note, of a strong democracy with checks and balances that are intact as the founders intended them to be. But in the last 6 years, what we've seen is a systematic assault on our democracy. And the reason I call it the end of America is that I look back at other times and places where democracies were systematically closed down, or would-be despots have crushed a pro-democracy movement. And what I saw is that there's a blueprint, and that would-be despots always do the same 10 things to close down an open society, and that we're seeing those 10 things now. So in answer to your question, it doesn't have to be the end of America if we wake up in time and push back in time and recognize what the blueprint is and how dangerous it is.
Sure.
But if we sit around thinking democracy will always protect us and we don't need to do anything, then we are very close to essentially a closed society, a police state.
Well, in light of these 10 steps, I mean, maybe it's kind of an inevitable problem with any sort of republic along the lines of Madison's sort of prescient statement. I mean, maybe we are perhaps at the end. Maybe that it will take something this extreme to either revitalize the republic, the system that we once had or that we still have. We have various sorts of shreds kind of coming apart at the seams. But then again, I mean, maybe this is sort of a call for, you know, if this system doesn't work, perhaps this extraordinary 10-step descent into the system that we're having right now, maybe this is a call for the American people to sort of possibly, you know, take arms, I suppose.
Well, I mean, okay, I'm just sort of collecting myself to respond. I mean, here's the problem. Okay, we have no idea in America what a closed society is actually like to live in. And so in response to your suggestion, it's not that simple. I mean, we have to not let it get to that point because, you know, people took up arms in the resistance after the National Socialists had exerted systematic pressure, which very much parallels these pressures, mm-hmm. on what was, people forget, a living parliamentary democracy, a modern state. And, once the state has engaged in certain kinds of repression, ordinary citizens with arms can't do very much. And if you think about what will it take to oppose an America that is unconstrained by democracy, it would take another world war.
Yeah.
So we don't want to go there. Let me just stress, it's like so not, it is so, we think we're stressed out now, you know, wait until, we more fully imagine or fully perceive what it's like to live in a closed society. Here's what I'm trying to alert people to. I looked at concrete moments in history. Italy in the 20s, again, another parliamentary democracy, people forget. Germany in the 30s, East Germany in the 50s, Czechoslovakia in 1968, Pinochet's coup in 1973 in Chile, and the crushing of the democracy movement in China. And what just leapt up off the pages is that, you know, there is, as I said, this blueprint, and it looks very much as if someone influential in the White House has studied these sort of classic steps to closing a society from the past and is recycling the greatest hits of basically fascism and totalitarianism. And I don't use those words rhetorically. I use them technically. Mm-hmm. We're not just seeing tactics being reproduced from Germany in 1930, 1931, 1932. We're actually seeing sound bites reproduced, language reproduced, imagery reproduced. I mean, I started wanting to write this book because I was getting this creepy feeling of deja vu. You know, what was it about the image of people burning Dixie Chicks CDs in a pile that resonated so much? Of course, Goebbels created quote-unquote spontaneous gatherings in 1933 of people burning books that were critical of the regime. What was it about the scene of, you know, the notion they were embedding reporters? Well, the National Socialists pioneered the embedding of reporters. William Shearer was embedded. Leni Riefenstahl was embedded. What is it about, you know, the image of young Republican staffers, identically dressed, menacing people, counting the vote, that seemed so familiar? And then when I was reading the history of Mussolini and the history of National Socialists, I saw again these scenes, classic tactic to close down an open society. You send the Arditi, the black shirts, identically dressed in Italy. You send the brown shirts, identically dressed in Germany, in what is still a democracy, to menace voters. I mean, in 1938, 99% of Austrians voted ja to be annexed by Germany because it was an identical scene. The brown shirts were standing outside, you know, menacing people who were counting the vote. So again, you saw what I've started to call historical fingerprints. I mean, your listeners should take a look at Triumph of the Will and this scene where Hitler, and I go there, and I don't go there lightly. We have to learn from history, and I'm Jewish, and I've lost relatives to the Holocaust, but I believe we honor the victims by being willing to look at this. Hitler's descending in a plane, greeted by his sort of paramilitary forces. They crowd around the door. He says, you know, we need your help to accomplish our mission. And you look at the staging of Mission Accomplished, and, you know, it's literally sequence after sequence is just identical. You look at things like, you know, and it's not just images. You look at things like how, oh, my Lord, it was the parliament before the National Socialists, who were not even Nazis. They were good, conservative, you know, decent Germans, who dismantled the Constitution and who, in the wake of a scare tactic about a terrorist assault on, you know, the parliament, the Reichstag, they passed the enabling acts, which said, okay, we can open your mail, we can listen in on your phone, you know, we'll close down mass marches and rallies. And they passed it because they were afraid of looking unpatriotic. Yeah. And their weakening of the Constitution is what allowed the National Socialists to do what they were then going to do. I guess it is so important for us to look at this blueprint, because when we see all these pieces fitting together, we realize that we are in an extraordinary crisis point where we have to rise up. I would not say rise up with arms, but certainly take to the streets and press representatives and confront the abusers like other democracy movements.
I suggest the rise up in arms with a certain degree of hyperbole, because people are going to Washington. They've gone there to protest the last couple of weeks about the war, and there are people getting arrested for reading the Constitution on public property, on a place where they are supposed to have freedom of assembly. So given this, and given the fact that, you know, well, frankly, Nancy Pelosi isn't going to proceed impeachment actions against Bush.
Yeah.
So what then could really be done?
Yeah. You know, this is a very sad conversation in a way, although it will end hopefully, because I'll reach the answer in a minute. When I wrote this book, I thought it would be very controversial and that people would be saying, oh, come on, not America. On the contrary, what I'm finding is that Americans across the political spectrum are already there. They know something very serious and dangerous is going on. And they're like saying what you're saying, which is we've tried it all. We've tried democracy already. We've tried the marching. We've tried emailing our congresspeople. Things are shifting into overdrive. And you're right to notice that. I mean, there's this horrible phase in a closing democracy when leaders and citizens still think it's a democracy, but the people who have already started to close it are just kind of drumming their fingers, waiting for everyone to realize that that's not the dance anymore. And there's the scene of like Mussolini moving in to Rome, and his people have already marched on Rome, and the leaders of parliament still think they can negotiate with him, and they keep offering him cabinet positions. Mm-hmm. And he's just like waiting for them to realize that he's not dancing that dance anymore. And I think of this a lot looking at Congress right now, because they're like, they keep doing democracy, and they keep not noticing that the Bush administration isn't, you know, they're like in another game plan. You know, it's like, and Congress is like an abused woman that keeps thinking, surely my boyfriend will, you know, be nice now. You know, what do you mean you're not turning over your emails? We're Congress. You know, you can't just not listen to us. So you're right to notice the American people are getting it before Congress is. The people in power right now are no longer engaged in the democratic social contract. And so it does take us recognizing that we can't, at this point, heal democracy only through conventional means of democracy. So Nancy Pelosi is saying we're not going to impeach. Guess what? The founders didn't intend for Nancy Pelosi to decide what the people are going to do when there's this kind of criminal assault on the Constitution and checks and balances. It's up to us, and that's why we've started the American Freedom Campaign, which is a democracy movement, which now has 5 million members in really like 2 months across the political spectrum. And we're driving a grassroots movement to push, you know, to confront Pelosi and to confront the leaders in Congress, to let them know that this is an emergency. It's not business as usual. And they can't unilaterally take issues like that off the table. Now, impeachment is not yet an AFC position. This is just me speaking for myself. But from the historical blueprint, seeing what is now in place, it is not safe to leave those people in power anymore. And I'm saying this to Republicans and Democrats alike. It's not safe to entrust the next election to them. So I think we don't just need to move forward with impeaching Bush and Cheney. This is me speaking personally, not for the AFC. But from the historical blueprint, we need to do it now, and we need also to prosecute for treason, because it's not enough to get people like this out of power. You have to get them behind bars.
But in terms of, if the AFC can't adopt a sort of position of like, wait, we need to impeach this guy because he's basically going ahead and ripping up the Constitution, then in what sense, I mean, is this going to be effective? I mean, this kid, Andrew Meyer, who got tasered by the police in front of John Kerry.
Right.
And John Kerry, clearly, in all the three video angles I saw, he's seeing this kid being torn, taken away by police. He has a history of doing this himself, and he does nothing as this is happening. If our own sort of powers, if the Democratic candidate for 2004 can't actually recognize this, then what hope is there really for any of us?
Okay, you know, this is a really interesting conversation, because I think the country is moving into a really amazing shift. I didn't say the AFC would never take that position. Mm-hmm. I said it's not a formal position yet.
Gotcha.
Because we're a grassroots movement, so we're listening to where the American people are. But what I'm hearing, and this is really a shift in the last 6 weeks, and it's partly the power of ideas. You know, suddenly we're breaking through the kind of fog of fear and fog of, you know, manipulated terror threats and, you know, the bogus hype about security issues. And by the way, step one of the blueprint is that all would-be despots invoke a terrifying internal and external threat, and often it's a real one that they then hype and inflate. But finally, people are kind of shifting into, okay, we have to impeach. Democracy isn't going to do it. So that's notable. And what I'm hearing is that the center is radically shifting to confront, get them out, impeach. You can't. It's not safe. So I think that what has to happen now is citizens need to urgently drive that frame in a principled way, not a hysterical partisan, you know, impeach, but a kind of principled bipartisan, let's look at what the founders intended, let's look at the dangers, you know, to all of us, Republican and Democrat, if we don't get these people out of there immediately. I mean, we don't have any time. You know, Blackwater, I was talking to you on the way over about how literally freaked out I am. I mean, I'm actually having trouble sleeping because of what I know about Blackwater. Blackwater just got another $1 billion contract after massacring 17 innocent civilians in Iraq, okay? They operate fully outside the law in Iraq. Yeah. Order 17, Paul Bremer guaranteed that they were unaccountable. So it's not just the Iraqis who have to worry about Blackwater. The second step in the 10-point blueprint is to create a paramilitary force that's not answerable to the people. This is how in Italy, Mussolini closed a democracy using the black shirts. And this is how, in Germany, Hitler closed a democracy using brown shirts. Paramilitary forces exert pressure on civilians. So what Americans don't know is that Blackwater is already operating in the United States. Homeland Security already brought them in to patrol the streets of New Orleans after Katrina. Yeah. And Jeremy Scahill reported that they were firing, or contractors were firing on civilians. We don't know, most of us, that Blackwater's business model calls for increased deployment here in the United States in the event of, say, a natural catastrophe or, quote, a public emergency. And with Defense Authorization Act 2007, it is the president who's hand-in-hand with Blackwater, who now has the unilateral power to determine what is a national emergency that calls for a, quote, restoration of public order. And I just want to tell you that the invoking of a national emergency and the call to restore public order is the 10th step in the blueprint to close down an open society. And it's exactly... So when I say we don't have any time, I think you're right. I think that we all have to kind of... But having this conversation with you and a few other conversations recently is persuading me that the center is really shifting. The grassroots, the mainstream, is realizing this is an unprecedented crisis, and it calls for unprecedented confrontation. So, yeah, I think it's time to, I personally think it's time to confront Nancy Pelosi and also to make the case bipartisan that whatever fears Republicans have of our system of checks and balances being temporarily in Democrats' hands is nothing compared to the fear for all of us of what's going to be a police state very soon if we don't get them out of there.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm wondering if a bipartisan commitment is really even possible. I mean, we saw this remarkable, remarkable failure to restore habeas corpus that all the Republicans, except, right, I believe, two, stood against. And also, you know, you were mentioning this notion of, and it's in the book, about enemy combatants and how anybody can be singled out for any reason, right, that Bush has that particular sort of authority.
Any president now.
Any
Giuliani.
President.
We
That's
think
true.
Bush is bad.
Yeah.
Giuliani is clearly the anointed successor. And if he takes office in a corrupted election, I talked at the end of the book about the many ways the blueprint shows you can corrupt and derail an election. I mean, most people don't realize in America that in closing societies and closed societies, they still have elections.
Yeah.
They're just deeply corrupted.
Yeah.
In a Giuliani administration, you know, he said he wants to double the size of Guantanamo. Mm-hmm. You know, there will be no constraints on his administration if we don't reverse, restore the rule of law before then. But I'm sorry, what were you saying?
Well, I was basically sort of saying that, okay, because of these very oppressive sorts of laws against activists or anybody who protests, anybody could be singled out.
Anybody, not even activists. Let me just clarify for listeners. Okay, this sounds mind-blowing. The president, any president, says he has the power to call you or me or this guy who's about to serve us coffee or this woman out in the street or your local Republican soccer mom an enemy combatant.
Yeah.
Lock us up in a Navy brig, 10 by 12 foot cell for 3 years in solitary confinement, making it difficult for us to see our families, talk to a lawyer. And psychiatrists know that solitary confinement makes sane people insane. So anyone can can be totally innocent and still be treated like this. And the way a weakening democracy closes down is in tipping points. It's not a linear progression. So we're at the point right now where if I read in the Washington Post tomorrow that someone I identify with, an editor, a journalist, opposition leader, animal rights activist, right, who's now they've expanded the definition of terror to include animal rights activists, a classic fascist shift, and I mean that technically, to expand who's a terrorist, who's an enemy of the state, who's a saboteur, right? So if I read that someone I identify with has been called an enemy combatant, that's the point at which I go silent. You know, we all have our levels of courage, and I'm just not brave enough to keep talking after that news. So that's how fragile our democracy is right now. You talked about the tasering of Andrew Meier. So because I was because I know Goebbels and I know the blueprint, I was so not surprised that that happened at the University of Florida, because I've got a whole chapter on how Goebbels and Mussolini pioneered putting pressure, state pressure, on state universities to put pressure on students and administrators. And so the University of Florida is answerable to the Board of Regents, which is answerable to the state legislature, which has close ties to Jeb Bush.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have to say the tasering of Andrew Meier happened right on schedule. I mean, the blueprint is predictive in terms of time. Like, I can tell you what's ahead. You know, I was predicting in November, and it's not that I'm a genius. It's that the blueprint is so clear. You can predict in November what's coming 6 months down the line. So,
well, what is coming 6 months from now?
Well, I'll tell you in just a second. It's not good unless we take action. When the state begins to legalize torture, it starts by legalizing torture of people that ordinary citizens consider marginal. Brown people, scary Muslim names out on an island, whatever, torture them, whatever, right? Now, those of us who care about human rights won't write it off, but the majority of, not just Americans, Germans, it's human nature, are like, whatever, I don't identify with them. In the early 30s, torture was still illegal. National Socialists weren't in power. But the SA, you know, people don't realize they didn't start with concentration camps. They started with these makeshift torture cellars where they would take people Germans didn't identify with, anarchists, communists, gypsies, Jews, homosexuals. But then inevitably, once the state starts to use force and strip citizens of due process or strip prisoners of due process, there is a blurring of the line. And sooner or later, again, right on schedule, you start to see people getting hurt or abused who look more like you and me. Sooner or later, Germans started to see the abuse in these torture cellars of editors, journalists. It's always the same cast of caricatures, opposition leaders, lawyers, labor leaders. And at that point, dissent went quiet, even before the nationalists, you know, before Hitler was chancellor. So what you can predict is that, okay, when I saw that the Military Commissions Act was passed and they were starting to torture brown people, I predicted to friends, and again, it's not rocket science, that the first prisoners to be tried in the military tribunal system would be white and English-speaking. And indeed, David Hicks, an Australian, was among the first prisoners to be tried. So what is predictable is that more and more citizens are going to start to get hurt in the exercising of their free speech and the exercise of dissent right about now. I'm not surprised to see more and more reports, although I'm scared, of abuse, of intimidation of citizens at airports. Mm-hmm. I have a chapter on the TSA watch list. I'm on the list, or I was for a year and a half. People like Richard Murphy, a constitutional scholar, are on the list. Anti-war activists are on the list. ACLU staffers are on the list. So that's just annoying in a working democracy to be searched, you know, at that level. But what is very disturbing is reports I'm getting, but it's predictable, that the increasing level of intimidation of citizens, of people around the country in airports, this is so mind-blowing. They're standing in line at security, and suddenly TSA agents will yell freeze, and everyone will have to freeze for half an hour, and then, you know, the exercise is over. But then you see this Mills College professor, she, I think, was Turkish-American. She was stopped at San Francisco Airport, told not to move during her questioning, and that if she moved, it would be considered assault on her interrogator, and she wasn't allowed to go home. She was sent back, you know, she couldn't go home. She was sent back. Her visa was denied. Classic fascist tactic, by the way, to, you know, control borders more tightly. And, you know, I went up to Vermont to finish copy editing this book, and I opened my suitcase where my computer was, and there was a letter inside my suitcase from TSA saying, you know, we've been through your stuff, basically. So I don't like these echoes. You know, I note that the National Socialists used to make people freeze in their camps, and they would abuse them if they moved. And what you're likely to see, unless we push back, you know, the New York Times just reported more and more incidences of abuse or intimidation of passengers who are traveling, and I'm really unhappy about this death in Phoenix, frankly. Mm-hmm. But again, it's predictable. Once you say, okay, the state permits torture, then any random thug, you know, any police officer who doesn't like New York Jewish women or whatever, you know, is going to feel empowered to push the line. You know, it doesn't even have to be that sinister, that intentional. It's that human nature shows that once you start to sanction abuse, there's mission creep.
Yeah. But inarguably, though, people are sanctioning this kind of thing. I mean, I'll give you a couple of things I'll throw at you. First of all, with the Andrew Meyer circumstances. I mean, a lot of people thought that, oh, well, here's this young punk who doesn't deserve, they should, you know, I've read a lot of the comments on the various sites, and it was really
shocking.
Astonishing to me to see, like, you know, yeah, they should have killed the kid, or they should have really seriously hampered him. I've had, you know, liberal friends of mine I've discussed this with, and they think that this is just some real opportunist kind of kid when, you know, he's just a confused kid, in my view, anyway.
Can I jump in there?
Oh, yeah.
This is a really fascinating, very disturbing psychological response of people who are being traumatized. And, you know, a country has a psyche, just like an individual has a psyche. And so there will be collective defense mechanisms. They're very dangerous, though, because they keep people from acting when they need to. You mentioned how John Kerry sat still when Andrew Meyer was tasered, and everyone in the audience sat still. And this completely echoes scenes in...
People were laughing. People were laughing
as this was
happening. If you watch the videos, there's this, like, there's people on the side. There's a handful of students who are in the back who are saying, what are you doing? But for the most part, the entire audience sits exactly still, and some people are laughing, and they actually applaud as the kid gets dragged out.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I mean, you should see the videos. And not only that, but the YouTube, on YouTube, they've taken the video, and they've actually remixed it to Monty Python, The Holy Grail, and they've also remixed it to, they did an MC Hammer remix where they said, don't tase me, and they cut it with MC Hammer approaching. So if this to me suggests, if we are talking about a coping mechanism,
yeah,
or if we're talking about a cultural response,
yeah,
this is how they are responding
right
to this. So as a result, I mean, you know, we're talking about a tiny sliver of that's left, and you were talking about, you know, AFC possibly having some effect in pressuring Pelosi on this kind of thing. But if there is such a sliver, if they're going to be taking your laptop, and I know this because I actually always pack my laptop on my backpack whenever I go on a plane,
right,
because I know they're going to search through it. I've had friends who have had their cameras and their laptops taken from TSA. And so what I'm saying...
Confiscated?
Yeah, confiscated.
Not returned?
Not returned.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
That's a new piece of information.
No, it's a writer friend of mine had this happen to him, and he was extremely upset, and I said, no, that's
what grounds did they give him for that?
They didn't give any grounds. They just put a little slip in his suitcase, and I have no idea why. But the point I'm trying to make here is that if they can, you know, okay, so I can take my laptop on a carry-on bag when I go onto a plane, but there will soon come a point where they'll start confiscating my carry-on bag. Really, what can really be done in this? I mean, I don't think confrontation is really enough here.
Okay, well, let me get to your question, but you're right to see that escalation is the direction once, and the founders knew this. God, this makes me crazy. The founders, you know, drafted the Bill of Rights and the Constitution in an atmosphere of fear because they were afraid of exactly this. They knew perfectly well from their own lived experience that an American despot could arise in America to oppress Americans, and that human nature tends to abuse power if it's unchecked. And they knew the dangers of a standing army not answerable to the people, because King George's men were ransacking their homes and, you know, raping colonial women. You know, they knew, using blanket warrants. That's why we have the Fourth Amendment. They knew, you know, the dangers of any arrogation of unchecked power. I mean, why were they so obsessed with due process? Because, you know, they had come from places. Tom Paine was prosecuted for sedition, could have been hanged for writing the Rights of Man. You know, he could have, you know, Quakers were tortured for their religious beliefs from the places the founders had come from. So that's why they set up this amazing system that we are just falling asleep while it's being dismantled. So let me speak to the denial thing first, and then I'll speak again to what can be done. And just let me sort of skip through the first four steps so people really know how urgent this is. The first, I mentioned the invoking an internal and external threat. The second, I mentioned the paramilitary force. The third is surveillance apparatus aimed at ordinary citizens, and you're right to notice the ratcheting up of the levels of surveillance. The fourth is to arbitrarily detain and release citizens, like with the TSA detentions. And then you skip ahead to targeting key individuals like Dan Rather, Bill Maher, Dixie Chicks, but more aggressively like the JAG lawyers who tried to defend the detainees. And, you know, then you get to restricting the press. I've got some very disturbing examples of journalists being hurt in Iraq for reporting independently, and journalists being harassed and targeted here at home. And finally, you get to subvert the rule of law and make it easier to declare martial law, which we now know, the president can do in a heartbeat without notifying Congress. So all of these are very bad, and democracy activists all over the world are like, you know, these are blinking red lights. So denial. What I was going to say is that scene of people sitting still in a lecture hall, you see that same scene in memoirs of Victor Klemperer, Count Kessler in Berlin in 1930, 31, 32. Civilized people, it's still a democracy, right? The National Socialists aren't in power yet as a majority party. But the paramilitary is active, you know? There are thugs around. So people are sitting in a lecture hall, civilized, decent people who are saying things like what we're saying now. Surely this, you know, surely we'll come to our senses. And someone asks a pointed question about the National Socialists, and they get dragged out of the lecture hall, and everyone else sits in silence. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's a silence. You see this again and again. Okay, and then what you also see, you talked about people making a joke, and I've also seen the threads in response to some of these abuses, the tasering and this death in Phoenix. And it's extraordinary how sadistic they are and how determined they are to blame the victim. I've seen these threads saying, well, he was obnoxious, or, yeah, well, if she had just sat quietly, nothing would have happened. So this is a classic infantile form of magical thinking where people are so reluctant to think that daddy could hurt them, and they're so eager to think that there is a safe space for them to inhabit where they won't get hurt, that they want to have there be a narrative in which that victim provoked it themselves, the violence was justified, and if they don't do X or Y, they will be safe. Mm-hmm. And what people have got to understand is that in a truly closing society, nobody is safe. There is no such thing as a safe place in a real police state. Sure. People really don't get it. They say things like, why should I be afraid of being surveilled? I'm not doing anything wrong. They don't understand that in a real police state, they manufacture evidence against you. And it doesn't, I mean, I had this extraordinary experience. I mean, we just have no idea. You know, and you know, 2 years ago in America, it would have been unthinkable that you would justify the electrocution of someone for asking an aggressive question of, yeah, you know, a political candidate. That's what America, yeah, is supposed to be for. That's what distinguishes us from states all over the world where people, you know, Myanmar, where people get shot for marching in the street.
Yeah, yeah.
So the blueprint, you asked, what does the blueprint call for? I wonder if I should tell you my extraordinary experience. I mean, when people think, oh, there's a safe place, there is no safe place, as James Baldwin said, in a closing society. No matter if you're Republican, no matter what your politics are, Ernst Röhm, you know, was murdered. I mean, fascist leaders are continually turning on their inner circle. I was up against the guy, one of the architects of the Patriot Act, in a debate on C-SPAN. And I was seeing him thinking, he didn't say this, but I pointed this out, that historically, it's not like if you're aligned with the regime in a closed society, you're safe. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm on the TSA watch list now, but he could be on the TSA watch list tomorrow if Bush doesn't like his advice about the Patriot Act or civil liberties.
Sure.
You know, so I had this experience where I was in a green room at Fox, and I was chatting with a conservative guest about the detainees at Guantanamo, and he said, oh, you know, they're all terrorists. And I said, well, actually, there are reports they're abusing women in Iraqi prisons, and there are reports that there are minors held at Guantanamo. And I'll get you those reports. They were Human Rights Watch reports. And it was a very civil exchange. The next day or two, I saw a blind item in page 6 that said that I had said that in a green room at Fox that U.S. soldiers were sodomizing minors at Guantanamo. And I was flipping out, wow, as you can imagine. And no amount of calling page 6, emailing page 6 could get a retraction or a response.
Yeah.
But in a closing society where you increasingly criminalize speech and call more and more kinds of speech treason, that kind of speech, it doesn't matter that I didn't say it. I can't prove I didn't say it, you know, and if they say I said it, you know, that eventually kind of speech gets criminalized, and then I get charged with treason.
Sure.
And there is no, your innocence, people don't get that in a really closed society, your innocence doesn't protect you.
Yeah.
In a system of checks and balances and the rule of law, your innocence protects you.
There is one thing you touch upon in this book, and I think it really is an important distinction to make, and that is the unfortunate, you know, the memory of the American public. It's quite lacking. I mean, here we are 4 years after Abu Ghraib and all those photos circulating the rounds. But even in your book, I would even argue that you mentioned that the Patriot Act passes overwhelmingly. But we forget that there was, in fact, one Congress member who actually stood up to that, and that was Barbara Lee.
Huh.
And I do forget that.
Tell me more.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, the one solitary vote against the Patriot Act was Barbara Lee, who was actually in California, where I used to live close by, a district close to where I used to be. And she was pilloried for daring to suggest something different. And yet, that's 6 years ago. Nobody remembers it.
Right.
Abu Ghraib, nobody remembers that. So if people can't remember these things, and if these things are sort of twisted by the media, as your page six item was, and, and if things like Guantanamo Bay are kind of kept out of sight, out of mind, then what hope the future, really? I mean, it's sort of like maybe a 2008 election might help, but in light of rather tepid response by the Democrats, they're going to learn a harsh lesson, you know, come November.
Well, you're right to ask all these questions. At the end of the book, I play out a series of what-ifs based on the historical blueprint. It's very unlikely, unless we rise up now, that there can be a transparent election in 2008. And if you look at the White House, they're not acting like people who have an election to win. And another thing that disturbs me a lot is they're making strategic long-term decisions, not the kinds of decisions of people who think they might essentially be out of there in 18 months. And when I say out of there, what I mean is in a closed society, you can have a new nominal figurehead, and as I said, even elections, and as I said, that figurehead is likely to be Giuliani, but it's the same basic coterie, you know, in power. There are many classic plays in the what-if scenario, according to the historical record. One is a hyped threat, a really scary hyped threat close to the election. I just read in the news today that the White House is doing an exercise to detonate a dirty bomb in three U.S. cities. It was supposed to happen October 15th to 18th, and it wasn't disclosed to Congress.
Wow.
I know. So that's exactly the kind of thing that you are likely to see leading up to an election in a weakening democracy, something that freaks people out so bad that they just, like, yield. Another thing you're likely to see, you know, when I read about the U.S. attorney scandal, again, reading Goebbels, I wasn't surprised because Goebbels did exactly the same thing that the White House sought to do, which is a purge of all the U.S. attorneys, in April of 1933. And it's a tactic that's been reproduced by would-be dictators subsequently. You just purge the civil service, focusing on lawyers and judges with your cronies, and replace independent thinkers with your cronies, and then you basically don't need a coup, because in a close election, had they purged all the U.S. attorneys without actually a blogger, you know, sounding the alarm, it would be the end of America already, because in a close election, those are the people who prosecute voting rights groups and determine the outcome of a tight count. So the months leading up to a national election are very unstable in a closing democracy. And what hope? Okay, we need to start thinking differently. We need to realize that we are in a fight for our democracy the way other democracy movements, like in Tiananmen Square, like in People Power in the Philippines, like the democracy movement that brought down the wall in 1989, that's what we need to model ourselves on. It can't be business as usual. So there are a lot of things we can do. I mean, first of all, I am seeing movement. Like you mentioned Barbara Lee. And one reason the Democrats have been so passive is that the Republicans, or the White House, I don't want to tar all Republicans with this, have managed to create a frame where any kind of critique of the dismantling of civil liberties is kowtowing to Al-Qaeda, right? So we have a lot of power. You do and I do. Right? Because you have this voice that you're using in this very classically patriotic way. I mean, this is what the founders intended, is for people to not leave it to the mainstream media, not leave it to the pundits, not leave it to the constitutional scholars, but for us to do it. So you have power, I have power, all of us have power to shift the debate. I mean, we're seeing some movement. 7 weeks ago, I think, Hillary Clinton wasn't opposed to torture. in public. And now she is opposed to torture, and that's partly this drumbeat of the AFC and its fellow, you know, partner organizations reframing the torture issue so Americans understand it doesn't keep them safer and it jeopardizes them personally. We just got Obama to commit to our pledge, you know, in beautiful language, you know, again, reproducing our language. So we're driving, these 5 million citizens are, you know, through their pressure, having an impact on the candidates. I believe they can also have an impact if it's 10 million, 15 million, 20 million on Congress and on the culture at large to ask different questions. And to make it possible then, and then this is what happens in a culture, what then is possible is for instance, judges to think more independently and to say, and I'm seeing more judges, rulings like this. I'm seeing more rulings, key rulings, saying things like, even in a time of quote-unquote war, the founders didn't intend for the executive to have this much power. And really people, I don't think, felt free to say that widely 6 months ago or a year ago in their rulings. So that's a shift in the wind. And there are other things we can do more aggressively. I mean, certainly this confronting of Pelosi, certainly what do other democracy movements do? They stage nationwide mass protests that shut down society. Mm-hmm. And I think it's time for that, not fringe. I mean, the left always does it wrong. You know, it's always like the Answer Coalition with 20 people in Birkenstocks. Yeah, yeah. I mean, no disrespect to them. But
like these guys who were going to the protest dressed up as a sort of statement, like, we are lawyers who are against the war.
Exactly. So like that's our model. Pakistan is our model. I mean, what happened in Pakistan was, you know, there was this crackdown. And citizens at the heart of society, lawyers, judges, again, you know, those scenes of people in business suits sitting in the street, like, brought Pakistan to a halt.
Yeah.
And brave lawyers and judges pushed back. And that's what you're going to see is, with this shift in the wind, individual JAG lawyers, individual judges, individual Republicans, contractors, Secret Service people are going to start saying, no, I can't do this anymore. And so there has to be nationwide strikes of people at the heart of civil society, especially Republicans and independents. There has to be massive pressure on Congress. We have to make the case to Congress. Here's why they're so passive. One reason is surveillance. In a surveillance state, everyone, all the congressional Democrats, know that the White House knows who they had an affair with, what their addiction is, what, you know, what medication they're on, what their accountant did with their taxes that could be questionable. That's why they're so passive, one reason. And I think I make it clear in the book that whatever the short-term shame or embarrassment of having your secrets exposed or having a personal smear is nothing to the mortal danger of shifting into a police state. So I think by presenting this argument to Congress, they will recognize the short-term embarrassment. You know, at the end of the book, I say, you know, Congress people, leaders have to basically out themselves in order to fight this fight and say, you know what, I had an affair. I'm sorry. You know what, I'm gay. I'm, you know, deal with
there
it.
Was,
you know,
there was one congressman who finally outed himself as an atheist.
That's interesting.
That's, yeah, it was the first
that
one
was
to
probably
do that.
Preemptive.
Yeah. Well, I have one last question because I know you have to go, but in light of what is to be done thing, which is vaguely reminiscent of Lenin in 1905, but you mentioned that bloggers can be the sort of corrective impulse in this conversation and also in the book, but I should point out that the biggest blog on the progressive side, which is the Daily Kos, it is actually very pro-Democrat in the sense that it doesn't really question the Democratic Party. There are two instances I can cite in relation to this to sort of show that it's really, in some sense, no different from the mainstream media. When, for example, we were talking about Andrew Meyer. We were talking about John Kerry's response. They were they didn't say anything in relation to how John Kerry reacted. When Cindy Sheehan decided to kind of challenge Pelosi, they essentially turned their backs to her and they called her an opportunist and a variety of sort of other epithets and the like. So given this, I mean, you know, if even like the Daily Kos, this allegedly alternative blog, cannot even question their own party. Yes, their goal is to get more Democrats into Congress, but simultaneously, one should likewise say, hey guys, you can't go ahead and vote for bills that are, you know, not reflecting the ideals of the founders set up. So what does this kind of, you know,
what about that? Okay, that's a really important question. And again, like, what time is it is the answer. If people think, like, the debate or the position you just described is a strategic position in a working democracy that, you know, a centrist or left-center Democrat is going to want to help support the Democrats as Democrats, right? That works in a democracy. There's good, I mean, you know, you can argue for or against, but it's reasonable tactical thinking. Okay. I personally, now that I'm encountering more and more of the blogosphere, wish there was a working behind-the-scenes alliance between the far left, which puts pressure from the outside, and the center left, which enacts on the inside, because that's how the other team does it. They make alliances quietly in back rooms, and we all would be a lot more productive with secret alliances
of
that kind.
If we all watch Survivor, I suppose.
But what we have to persuade people is, what time is it? And the tactical thinking that makes sense in a working democracy, we don't have the luxury for in a crisis of this kind, in a physical crisis. I mean, I don't know how to be clearer. The first people to be hurt if we slide 4 more inches down this slope and we don't enact, you asked what is to be done, the 10-point legislative agenda that the AFC is pushing, will stabilize democracy enough for us to rally our forces and push back. So that is what has to be done. It's points like restore habeas corpus, protect journalists from prosecution under, the Espionage Act, repudiate torture, no more warrantless wiretapping. That would stabilize things a lot. I think we need to add paper ballots and forbid Blackwater from operating on United States soil. But even Coase, even Mrs. Clinton, even many congressional Republicans, if they realize what time it is and that they themselves are at risk, unless we shift to the tactics that are more appropriate in a drastic emergency, which are different tactics, then you get different outcomes. And I'm seeing that. I'm seeing more aggressiveness. I mean, this cowed, pathetic Congress wouldn't have been confronting Blackwater 3 months ago. You know, now there's been a chorus of voices saying, we're Americans and this is not okay with us. You know, we're Americans and their abuse is taking place. You know, 3 months ago, Blackwater would have wrapped itself in the flag. The White House would have wrapped itself in the flag, and that would have been the end of it. So I do see that when people realize that the consequences of business as usual is that we and our families will get hurt, they get angrier and behave more effectively and more strategically.
They did that, and they also suggested that the wealthy should actually pay a 10 to 12% surcharge on the war, which I thought was a very interesting maneuver the Democrats did. But likewise, they also raised the debt ceiling. I mean, they could have actually went ahead and stood against that and say, look, this is a war that is out of control.
Right.
You can't continue to spend and spend and spend. This is a sort of problem. Instead, they raised the ceiling and they didn't take a stand. Many Democrats. Mm-hmm. So what I'm saying is that some of these things are very all fine and dandy. Some of the bills that actually get through are great.
Mm-hmm.
But there is still very much a business as usual mentality going on here. And so even among as we were sort of suggesting earlier, the alternative media, you know?
There is. I mean, I have to say, given what I've looked at in terms of the historical blueprint, I think we all on the left, pardon me, in the center and on the right, need to realize that the war is, in a way, the war is I don't want to say the least of our problems, but the war is a minor problem compared to how horrific a closed America would be for all of us. I mean, in a closed America, there would be no limit on the wars that a leader would unilaterally wage. In a closed America, there would be no force on earth that could constrain, you know, if you're rendering people in Macedonia in an America that has a vestigial democracy, you could render EU ministers who are getting in your way in an America that's not constrained by democracy. So I think we need to not obviously abandon the war, but realize the war is a symptom, and we've got a much bigger problem that we need to correct.
Gotcha. Well, Naomi, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Let me just conclude by saying, it's very important to know that historically there's no force on earth that can withstand millions of people rising up in a democracy movement to confront abusers. And so I invite us all to be, you know, leaders in democracy movement to restore the rule of law.
Not
we
that,
can
no.
do it.
Well, we hope so. Anyway, well, thanks.
Thank you.